While you're getting settled, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the second case on our calendar, A240201, Pebble Creek LLC versus Sow. And I believe the Attorney General's office is also appearing today. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. I understand that the time is being split between the respondent, Sow, 10 minutes, and the intervener, the Attorney General, 5 minutes. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. I'd ask that you all introduce yourself before you begin speaking. Identify your clients as well. This matter is being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted. And let us know how we can reference you this morning. All right. With that, counsel, anytime you're ready, we are ready for you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Christopher Kala. I represent Pebble Creek LLC, the appellants. I'll refer to them as the landlord in this matter. This is an appeal from a civil action in Hennepin County. The case started out as a basic non-payment eviction case that was amended to add several other claims that ultimately were not litigated. The defendant tenant raised a habitability defense. The court then ordered a monetary posting of $2,712 to be paid into the court. Thereafter, the tenant failed to pay the September posting requirement into court. The trial was canceled. A writ was issued. The $2,712 was not returned to the landlord. Under Rule 611, the appellant asked for a judicial review. That was affirmed in its entirety. The tenant is no longer in possession. The claims collateral to possession and the amended complaints have not been litigated further. The $2,712 has not been delivered to the landlord.
Can I just ask, has the statute of limitations expired on those additional claims?
I don't believe they have.
And is there some reason why you haven't commenced a new lawsuit to seek relief?
We were hoping to get remand from this court. They have been served.
Okay.
And they haven't technically been dismissed. The trial has just been canceled. So it's kind of in limbo as to the status of those claims. If we were to file a separate action, there's no dismissal of those claims. There's simply no trial pending.
So the claims are still alive in district court. Have you requested some additional proceedings in district court?
No.
Okay.
There are five issues before the court today. Some of them will be handed more time. First is the delay of the summons from the district court. The relief being requested there is that this court direct the state court administrators to issue prompt summonses after a complaint is filed in an eviction. The second issue is that there was an error by the trial court in determining the math of how much money should be posted according to Fritz. The third issue is the error in canceling the trial. The relief being requested is a remand from this court to the district court to proceed with those remaining counts. The fourth issue is the error in returning the funds to the tenant or their VLN payor. That undermines the security in Fritz.
Is there some legal authority to that issue, counsel, that requires the return of or the delivery of money deposited into court to the landlord? Is there some authority that directs that?
There's nothing expressly that lays out a formula or a step-by-step process, but if you look at Fritz, they were trying to address the tension that existed before 1973, that in non-payment cases, the only defense a tenant could really assert was they've paid the rent or that they have vacated. And Fritz, in 1973, the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized a common law defense to intertwine the covenants of habitability and the covenants, et cetera, of a landlord and the covenants of tenant to pay and combined them and allowed a tenant to defend against a non-payment case by asserting that the property is not in a habitable condition.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Mm-hmm. And the court recognized... Fritz
quickly
recognized a tension there between the tenant not having any real option except to pay or vacate and the tenant allowing kind of a hybrid process to put that money into court and then litigate the habitability defense. But the whole idea behind there is to provide security for the landlord for the delays inherent in litigation. And so to answer your question, is there anything that requires the court expressly to refund the money to the landlord? I would say no. But to take that money and not give it to the landlord undermines that exact security issue that Fritz tried to recognize, and that is providing security for the landlord during the delay inherent in litigation.
But the habitability defense hadn't been resolved yet, so there are fact issues there, correct?
Yes.
And so why didn't you just start a separate action then over lost rent, damages, whatever?
Certainly the landlord could do that, but the landlord already amended its complaint to include those claims here. And if every time...
Your second and third, they weren't done with permission of the court, correct? So you didn't even follow the court's, the rules of civil procedure to be allowed to amend the complaint.
Well, Housing Court Rule 610 allows such amendments. It's a very permissive...
In Housing Court.
Housing, yeah. This is a case in Hennepin
County. But these aren't Housing Court issues. These are, I mean, you've got a fraud claim. You've got a claim for damages. So, I mean, I think that, I don't know. So,
sure.
So
well,
why can we ignore the regular rules of civil procedure?
Well, I don't think we are ignoring those. We're acknowledging that Rule 610 of the Housing Court rules allows for such amendments.
It allows them if they're related to non-payment of rent. I mean, you have to agree with me, Mr. Kala, that there are all kinds of procedural anomalies in the manner in which this case has progressed, from the way that the complaint, from the way that the action commenced, to the amendment of the complaint a couple of times to add typical civil claims to what was commenced as a summary proceeding, which is an eviction action, and then the way that the district court handled it. I mean, all of it is very strange when I read the record. But I don't know that there's a... I'm trying to figure out where the error of law is or where the abuse of discretion lies in this sort of morass of kind of bizarre activities that happened with this case.
Well, I take your word bizarre to mean it's not...
It's
usual.
Unusual, sure. Yeah. It's unusual.
Sure.
I've never seen it happen. I mean, I was a district court judge for a long time. I never handled it this way. I never saw it this way. I'm trying to figure out where in this whole timeline, you know, we can intervene to say this was an error of law or this is an abuse of discretion.
So I think the fundamental mistaken premise is that when landlords come to housing court, the only thing they can do is evict people.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. What was?
I think the fundamental
faulty premise.
The only
thing they can do is
evict people.
Evict. Okay, sorry.
When you look at statute 484013, the Housing Court Calendar Program statute, and Housing Court Rule 602, the word evict never appears once. The only way a landlord can assert its authority to proceed in housing court to evict somebody is to take reference that it is an action under Chapter 504B. But in both 484013 and 602, expressly, the program must provide for the consolidation of landlord-tenant damage actions and actions for rent at the request of either party. That's at page 10 of my brief. Also on page 10, Rule 602.
But a court may not consolidate those claims unless all of the procedural requirements are met. And I think there's some question about whether the procedural requirements are met. That's sort of, I mean, if we have to read the whole statute. So
I'm willing to address that. And I think procedurally amending the complaint pursuant to Rule 610 of the Housing Court Rules and Rule 15 of the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure does exactly that. The court has jurisdiction over the defendant by virtue of them being served in the eviction action. They are within the personal jurisdiction of the court. The complaint was amended. It was served on defense counsel. It was filed with the court. It meets the procedural requirements of Rule 610 and Rule 15.
Does it mean, I mean, the second and third amended complaints occurred after the tenant answered, so those amendments under Rule 16 would have to be by leave of court.
Well, one of them.
One of them. The last, at least the last one.
Sure. I mean, one of them was simply clarifying the fraud claims. I mean, I don't believe the fraud claims weren't pled with specificity, but that was the allegation. So I just simply, well, I'll give you line by line where the fraud occurred day by day, issue by issue. It wasn't adding a claim per se. It was really kind of clarifying the fraud issue. But the general...
But there's a procedural anomaly there with the filing of the additional complaint without leave of court. You would agree, under the rule.
So I guess I'm not sure where Your Honor's finding the leave of court requirement.
In the rules of civil procedure? Once a defendant is answered...
Okay.
Then an amendment can only occur with leave of court.
So this is all happening certainly in full view of the court. I'm telling the court I'm going to amend. And I mean, if the court wants to say you can't amend, they never said you can't amend your complaint.
But they never said that you could either. And I mean, there are also rules for non-dispositive motions in Rule 115 of the general practice, and that requires 14 days notice and a notice of motion in motion. I mean, you see where I'm getting caught up in the procedural requirement that's in the statute?
Except the rule 115 of general practice doesn't apply to housing court to the extent that you can make oral motions in housing court.
Yeah, I understand.
I mean, and if this court wants to say, look, that's a little too fly by the seat of your pants for housing court, and we think there's a little bit more rigor required, that's fine. But until this time, housing court is very free-flowing, and it's not meant to prejudice people. If the defendant wanted an extension or a continuance to answer things, that's fine. I was never pushing that timeline.
The other thing that is concerning to me is I know how these housing court calendars work, and to add a fraud claim or a claim for monetary damage to the housing court calendar is also unusual in my experience. And it seems like those calendars are not particularly well equipped to accommodate full civil cases. Go ahead, count if you need some
Excuse
water.
Me.
Yeah. It seems as though those calendars are not set up to accommodate a full civil action. I mean, a fraud claim and a claim for damages for breach of contract are full civil actions.
Except they were all related back to the nonpayment and the fraudulent use of the credit card.
And the defense be entitled to a jury to decide those issues, though? I mean, that you don't get a jury in front of a housing court. But
actually, in evictions, you do get juries. Either party can request a jury in an eviction.
Okay.
Rent escrow is currently not, but evictions, absolutely. Evictions. And there wasn't a request.
And it requires a trial within 7 days if they do.
Yeah.
Well, that requirement has been disregarded by the housing court for years. And currently, that is no longer a requirement. The new statute...
Well, it isn't any longer, but I can tell you out in the sticks where I came from, we complied with that requirement.
Well, I wish I would have been appearing in this court case, but that's not... I mean, that's not how the housing, I mean, we get that. That's the other issue with the issuance of the summons, is that they delay these summonses for weeks, sometimes months, and then, like you say, the 7-day trial time doesn't really mean a whole lot if you've been waiting for 3 months for your summons.
Did you get your answer, Judge Kerr?
But it almost sounds to me like the bond, so to speak, or the prepayment is more essential in your system because you're going to have a delay. It's almost intrinsic, whereas under the statute, these things are supposed to be resolved within 7 days.
And most of the time, many times I should say, that when trials were being held very quickly, the judges would routinely not require a posting because really they would say, Counselor, we're going to have a trial in 7 days anyway.
Right.
Well, we can just, you know, we'll resolve it quickly. And, I mean, I'm not going to take that to the Court of Appeals every time I'm disenfranchised by that ruling, but here there wasn't a dispute as to when the trial should be.
Can I ask a slightly different question about the statute and about the procedural anomalies in this case? I understand that there were amended complaints that were filed. Was there ever a motion to consolidate? I didn't see one in the file. Did you ever move to consolidate the claims between the eviction action and the fraud claims and the claims for damages?
No. I simply felt that amending through Rule 15 and Rule 610 was sufficient.
So the statute, Subdivision 2, references consolidation.
Right, the program must provide for the consolidation of those different...
Consolidation is a different animal than amendment of the complaint. You would agree?
You don't think so? I think the word consolidation means many things to many people. I mean, I've had cases
where... Was the statute ambiguous?
Well, it's saying the housing program must provide for the consolidation.
So what does consolidation mean in the statute?
I think, in this case, it can mean that I am amending the complaint to add those other claims.
And what is... what is the definitional basis of that representation? I mean, we're tasked with now interpreting the statute, and what does consolidation mean? And you've told me what you believe it means, and I want to know what the basis of your belief is.
Well, I kind of put it out there in my initial brief, and I didn't get any response saying that that is an improper way to consolidate. If somebody would have come up with a housing court rule, a statute, a rule of general procedure from Hennepin County saying this is how you consolidate non-payment cases with fraud claims, I would like to see that, but I haven't seen any of that here.
What do we make of the fact that the rules of civil procedure treat amendment of the complaint and consolidation of claims as two separate things?
Then I would ask this court perhaps give some guidance as what does consolidation mean in 484.013.
Okay.
But as of yet, nobody has really provided me with any authority that says amending under Rule 15 and Rule 610 is an improper way to consolidate the claims.
And maybe on rebuttal, if you, in that 484.013 subdivision 2, it lists the kinds of claims that could be consolidated. So if you could just respond how and why you think fraud is included in that list.
Well, the fraud goes to the method of payment that the tenant tried to do. And so it's part and parcel the non-payment.
Where in the language of subdivision 2? Because that's a pretty specific list. And fraud seems independent of...
I would have been happy to litigate the fraud as a subsidiary or a subset of the non-payment or the damages claim. I mean, the damages for rent, I would have been fine litigating fraud as a subset of that.
It doesn't say that in the statute, though, in subdivision 2. It says criminal and civil proceedings related to violations of any state, county, or city health, blah, 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 code, escrow of rent proceedings, and actions for rent abatement, and chapter 504B claims. I don't see fraud in there.
There's also in 504B 173 is the application statute that allows a landlord to get damages when a tenant makes false application for their tenancy. That's a fraud claim. That's allowed under Chapter 504B.
You're saying it's 504B.17.
I can get you the statute. That wasn't the claim we were litigating here per se. But again, what I was trying to push, I see my time is up. What I was trying to litigate in this housing court case was that the tenant illegally used somebody else's credit card to pay for the rent, and my client was deprived of that money.
Okay, so you're saying it really is not a 504B point whatever claim then?
Correct. It's really
okay.
Part of the
All
action
right.
for
that,
rent.
That. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Counsel, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We will hear from respondent.
Good morning. My name is Ethan Scrivener, and I represent respondent, the tenant in this matter, Yada Emma Sow. Your Honors, this is a residential eviction case which resulted in Ms. Sow being evicted from her home approximately 11 months ago at this point. The issues before the court today are moot, with the possible exception of the return of funds to the Volunteer Lawyers Network Habitability Fund. To the extent that any of the issues are not moot, the court below did not err. The court below did not err by canceling the trial in this matter. Every week, trials are set, housing trials, eviction trials are set in Hennepin County. Frequently, posting is a requirement of those trials. Every time a tenant does not make that posting, the trial is canceled.
I mean, I understand why the eviction action has been canceled, why the eviction trial has been canceled.
Yeah.
The writ of recovery has been issued, and so that there's no trial that needs to be had. But there are remaining claims that are in district court, and so if the landlord in this case said, I want to litigate my remaining claims, then what?
So landlord has essentially said that the issue is that 484.013, first of all, does not mandate consolidation of claims for landlord-tenant damages and actions for rent.
But why shouldn't we read it the way that appellant is reading it. I mean, you've got the referee here ruling on the amended claims and saying, wait a minute, I'm not going to dismiss the fraud claim, but go ahead and plead it with more specificity. So isn't that good enough? I mean, nobody objected.
Certainly.
It appears I don't know, maybe you did below, I don't know.
Certainly, and I think the distinction there is that what landlord is arguing here is that the housing court referee was mandated to hear those claims. And there's nothing in 484013 or Rule 602 that mandates the referee to hear those claims. In fact, 602 says that a referee may hear landlord tenant damages actions, but there's no mandate to do that.
I think the question is, by addressing the new claims that were filed, did the landlord or did the referee actually just consolidate them without issuing a consolidation order?
No, and if that was the case here, then that would have been improper, as the court already discussed. I mean, there are procedural requirements in order to consolidate claims, right? So the proper procedure here would have been to initiate a conciliation court action. Minnesota Statute 491A01, subdivisions 3 and 9, lay out that conciliation court is the place to bring landlord-tenant damages actions
for $15,000. Is that the exclusive place to bring them, though? I mean, why doesn't 484013 sub 2 allow, and the Hennepin County Special Housing Court rules just allow the landlord to say, I have some claims that I want to add that are related to non-payment of rent, and these are the claims, and I want all of these claims consolidated into one action. Why isn't that sufficient under the rules?
Well,
and the statute?
Two reasons. First of all, I mean, there's still the issue of consolidation. I think that still requires a request. What landlord's position is essentially that plaintiffs, litigants, dictate to the court when claims will be consolidated.
And what does it mean to consolidate a claim?
That there are two separate existing claims, and I don't have Rule 42 of the Rules of Civil Procedure in front of me, but that's I think where this court should draw its definition. But that there are two or more existing claims, and they touch upon the same factual or legal matters, and that combining them into a single hearing it simply makes sense for purposes of judicial economy.
And why is it that Mr. Kalla's interpretation of consolidation for claims that are asserted separately in a cause of action, those are claims, that are asserted separately in an amended complaint, why isn't that sufficient?
Well, I think the big issue there is that consolidation is still within the purview of the district court to determine whether consolidation is appropriate under the circumstances.
Well, it seems like it's mandatory under some circumstances under subdivision 2.
I would disagree. I think subdivision 2 simply mandates a process or a procedure. I would also point out to the court that matters cannot be consolidated if consolidation leads to delay of the underlying eviction case.
Well, then how do we interpret the program must
Yep.
provide for the consolidation of landlord-tenant damage actions and actions for rent at the request of either party? That seems mandatory to me.
My reading of that is that it must provide for means that it must have a mechanism in place by which consolidation can occur. And even if it was mandating consolidation of cases, which I don't think the legislature went that far in dictating procedure to the court in that manner, but even if that's how it's supposed to be read, there's still a clear prohibition against delay of the underlying eviction case when consolidation is sought. Under the facts of this case, landlord would not simply move forward with the eviction case once the focus shifted to amending complaints, adding counts for damages, investigating alleged credit card fraud. So, I mean, this case was set for trial, I think, 3 weeks after the continued first appearance. That trial had to be rescheduled for more than a month later because of the delays caused. So I think either way, it runs afoul of 484013. I think 484013 read in conjunction with 602, again, just stating that this is, that the housing court referee may hear these claims. Makes it pretty clear that this is still at the discretion of the trial court, Your Honor. Additionally, Court below did not err in determining its posting amount in this case, and the issue is moot at this point. The posting was meant to secure a trial where Ms. Sow was going to be able to raise an affirmative defense based on landlord's alleged violations of the covenants of habitability. As we know, that eviction trial is just never going to occur. There's not any circumstance under which it could at this point. So remanding back to the district court to come up with a different dollar amount at this point, particularly given the existence of a new posting statute, it's effectively an academic exercise. Beyond that, the district court had discretion in determining what amount of posting was appropriate in this case. The district court did hear arguments from each party, initially set a posting amount, I believe, equivalent to 1 month's rent and then monthly rent going forward. After hearing arguments from counsel, nearly tripled that initial posting amount. I don't think there is an abuse of discretion there.
Counsel, I apologize. I have to go back to this statutory interpretation argument. This on subdivision 2, it seems to me like you're adding some words in that first sentence. So it reads, the program must provide for the consolidation of the action. And it seems to me you are adding, the program must provide for a procedure for the consolidation. So why is your interpretation reasonable under these circumstances when the legislature isn't limiting, it appears from the plain language of the statute, that it's not limiting this mandatory directive to providing for a procedure as opposed to just the consolidation of claims?
Certainly, I think that would conflict with, I believe it's subdivision 3 of the statute, though it could be 5, I cannot read my own note, which also says that the chief judge of the jurisdiction essentially assigns cases and determines which cases referees would hear. It would conflict with Minnesota Statute 484.69 subdivision 3, which says that the chief judge in each jurisdiction assigns any
It just says judge. It assigns a referee to the housing court program.
And essentially, and administers the cases. And I guess, you know, more specifically, 484.69 subdivision 3 says that the judge may assign any judge of any court within the judicial district to hear any matter in any court of the judicial district. And so I think by reading 484.013 subdivision 2 to say that no, in fact, once a housing court referee has a case in front of them, that consolidation has occurred the moment that a litigant says it has occurred or a plaintiff says it has occurred by amending a complaint, those two statutes then I think would be in conflict.
Okay.
Your Honor, I see my time is almost up. I would just briefly also note for the court that Minnesota Statute 504B.321 does not mandate any kind of timeline for issuance of the summons. The summons in this matter went out 5 business days after a complaint was filed. The first appearance in this matter was required to be held no less than 7 and no more than 14 days from issuance of that summons, and that's what occurred here.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the intervener.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Madeline DeMel, and I'm an assistant attorney general appearing today on behalf of the attorney general who intervened for the limited purpose of defending the constitutionality of Section 504B.335E, which was passed in 2023 and became effective January 1st of this year. Intervenor respectfully requests that the court reject landlord's constitutional challenge for 3 reasons. First, landlord has not carried its heavy burden to establish that the challenge statute is unconstitutional beyond any reasonable doubt. Second, landlord has no standing to challenge a statute that has not been applied in this case and that could not be applied on remand. And third, if the court reaches the merits of this challenge, though it need not, The statute is a permissible exercise of the legislature's constitutional authority to regulate evictions. I welcome the court's questions. I believe it would be the presumption against retroactivity, Your Honor. And I don't know that, and for the same reasons that the tenant no longer has possession of the premises, I struggle to envision a circumstance in which there would need to be some sort of reposting of security to also preserve the tenant's habitability defense for an eviction action in which the tenant no longer has possession. I don't know, again, that that would occur because that aspect of the proceeding is moot. Turning then to the standing piece for the challenge, I think the fatal flaw here is the lack of alleging any injury sufficient to confer standing. The injury that the landlord asserts is essentially an impairment of its argument on the exception to mootness that is raised in page one of the SIR reply brief. I think this impairment of argument is just that, an impaired argument and not a legally cognizable injury sufficient to confer standing. There are, I think, well-established justiciability doctrines that make it clear that not everyone can make every argument they might want to. And alternatively, even if this were a type of injury that could confer standing, the landlord should not be able to invoke it on the facts of this case based on the record below, specifically statements by the landlord that indicated willingness to agree to bifurcation at some point. Bifurcation of claims would have obviated any posting requirement. And so on this record, it doesn't make sense to have something that was agreeable at one point now be the basis of an injury that would confer standing. The record citation for that statement was index number 48 at page 25, paragraph 16 to 21. Ultimately, on the standing issue, I think it's the very same separation of powers argument that landlord would rely on for the merits of its constitutional challenge that really requires the court to dispose of that challenge on standing grounds. Reaching the merits without fully enforcing the Constitution's standing requirements would require the court to render an advisory opinion, which puts this court out of its constitutional lane. If the court does reach the merits, however, that analysis will turn on whether the effect of Section 504B-335E is substantive or procedural. As a threshold matter, duly enacted state statutes are presumed constitutional, and that is, of course, the case here. The statutory text of the challenge statute does not mention or in any way purport to change Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 6703. I think at worst, the statute could be read to modify the Fritz common law rule, but that rule is substantive in origin and not procedural. Fritz discusses at least three distinct substantive rights when it announces the posting rule, which include a tenant's covenant to pay rent, a landlord's covenant to maintain habitable premises, which is a statutory covenant, and then the common law right of tenants to raise a habitability defense in eviction proceedings, which also implicates attendant due process concerns for tenants. It's my reading of Fritz that Rule 67 really came into play and was mentioned as a mechanism for effectuating those rights. I see my time has expired, and with that, I would respectfully ask the court to reject the constitutional challenge. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. I'll begin by addressing the constitutional issues. I agree with much of what the intervener says, primarily that my challenge to the constitutionality of the statute is premised on this court entertaining the mootness argument of the tenant. If you find that it's not moot and remand, then the constitutionality issue does not even get reached. With regards to whether Fritz is a substantive announcement or a procedural announcement of rights, I think it is procedural. Certainly, Fritz announces that there is a recognizes that the common law right of habitability can be raised as a defense. But the procedure by which it declares how much money should be posted as security for the landlord is based in procedure, procedural rule 6703. And the problem, yes.
So my problem with your, if you're ready to transition to the security issue.
Yes.
Is that prejudgment security is almost never granted. It is here specifically in eviction actions, but your claim for back rent is, or rent owed, is another claim from whether you're entitled to recover the premises. And I understand you also brought that claim, but we're talking prejudgment security here. So that's a whole different beast than saying, oh, and you just get it. And so where's your authority for that?
My authority for that is to deny my request results in an absurd situation and a moral hazard, whereby tenants, even under the new rule, under the new statute, 504B335E, where the only posting is prospective, such that if the trial is more than 10 days out, the court can order ongoing rent.
So is it your claim that it should have been dispersed to your client, or that the court just should have held on to it until the rest of the claims were resolved? Because it's an unresolved claim. Unless there was the habitability defense.
I would be satisfied with either outcome, but to simply give it back to the tenant, right, that deprives the landlord of the security that Fritz recognizes. All a tenant has to do is say, you know, I think I'm going to lose this case. I'm not going to post my rent for September. I've gotten my extra months here. I'm going to get my money back. They can chase me in conciliation court or wherever. Case is dismissed. I'm gone.
So is that a, then a, back to what Judge Frisch was asking, are we guided then by whether it was an abuse of discretion by the district court? And if so, how did it, I know your client doesn't like it because it has to go chase down money now.
Money that 6703 already put into the court. There's no dispute that the money was unpaid. I mean, this is not a dispute that $2,700 wasn't paid or was paid. That is admittedly money unpaid to the landlord. So cover damages, all those types of things. The $2,700 was money that was never paid to the landlord. The only resolution then is, should that amount be diminished because of the habitability defenses?
Right.
And the moral hazard we have here is that tenants could theoretically raise spurious habitability defenses, post money. The property isn't uninhabitable.
Well, I get the policy reasons, but where's the law saying we can find it was an abuse of discretion?
Because to not give it back to the landlord eviscerates the security that Fritz recognizes. And if we always give money back to the tenants, just because there's no more trial, what incentive is there for tenants to pay rent? They can just come to court, not pay their rent, argue habitability, then put the rent into court, okay? Then, the day before trial, vacate. Case gets dismissed because of mootness. Then the case gets expunged because there's no judgment in favor of the landlord. That's absurd.
I appreciate the concerns that you're raising, which I do appreciate them. But it seems to me that this is an argument that should be made across the street and not in this courtroom about the policy reasons for doing things a certain kind of way.
I would welcome the opportunity to talk to the legislature about this. The problem is Fritz already says past rent should be posted and future rent. And 504B335E tells the Supreme Court, no, we don't think your view of adequate security for the landlord is appropriate in this case. And that's, I think, something this court can say, no, we think the Supreme Court in Fritz was correct, that adequate security for the landlord is important. And this statute eviscerates that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. I appreciate your arguments and your submissions. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time period.